water is becoming a real issue in this country. Either we have too much or we have too little, depending on where you are. And for some reason, we keep building houses in flood zones. Why do we do it? Today, we learn more about water, floods, and sea level rise. Thanks for listening, and thanks for subscribing to Learning More, where each week we bring you a new story about people, inventions, pop culture, and life. I'm Russ, and this week, okay, well, we're continuing a series here. In case you haven't noticed, we're talking about climate change. Okay, this one is really interesting to me because there's such extremes here in the United States. I'm in California, and each night when we run the dishwasher, we have to see, should we run it? Do we have enough in there? Maybe we should wait a couple of days. We just don't have the water here in the state. So it's a huge problem for us on that side of it. And then you turn on the news and you look in various other states and they're literally underwater. We've got a huge problem here and we've got to solve it. We've got to figure it out. So I am joined today by A.R. Siders, an assistant professor from the Disaster Research Center at the University of Delaware. Thank you for joining me today.
Yeah, thanks for having me. As you're talking about the water, the drought and the flood, I'm reminded I started working on climate change issues when I was working for the U.S. Navy. At the time, my boss, Admiral Titley, used to say that the problem of climate change is all about the water. It's too much or it's too little. It's in the wrong place or at the wrong time. And so I think about that a lot when it's climate change. It's drought or flood.
Right? Yeah.
Where's the water coming? When is it coming? Is it snowpack? Is it melt? What's happening with it? But yeah, water sort of is at the basis of all of this.
Totally. And that's the you summed up the whole issue right there. I mean, there's too much or too little. I have this dream of like, why don't we just put pipes somewhere and pipe it to California? We can use it. We don't have any.
No, and it's true, right? But then, so I grew up in Minnesota on Lake Superior. And so when you talk about pipes, you know, at one point there was, I don't know if it was an urban legend or a real plan, but at one point there was talk about putting a pipe out of Lake Superior and taking water from the Great Lakes up to California or, you know, out to the west in the dry. And of course, then everyone who loves the Great Lakes and their ecosystem sort of, No, we're going to, you know, destroy these ecosystems, because it sounds so simple to move it around, but actually it becomes really complicated in terms of how you spread out those effects.
I didn't say it was an easy idea.
No, it's certainly not. Yeah.
Okay. So let's talk though first. Okay. We've got the drought issues, but right now, you know, and you don't know when this is going to happen. It could happen at any point. There's coastal flooding and there's sea level rise and they're still building houses in these areas.
Well, I think so. Sea level rise is one of the climate change consequences that we talk about the most. And I think it's because it's one of the most obvious and it's the one you sort of see happening, right? You can watch the tide gauges go up. You can see how that's coming and it's sort of, it's still uncertain, but in some ways it's more predictable than, say, how climate change will affect hurricanes or will it affect hurricanes, right? There's a lot more uncertainty about that than sea level rise. And then, yeah, you said it, we're building in these flood-prone areas. We're actually building faster in the United States in flood-prone areas than we are outside of them.
Really?
In Delaware, for example, we're building 2.5 times faster in some places inside flood zones that have a 10% chance of flooding every year. So it's, you know, it sounds crazy, but there's such a demand to put housing there. And so you have this mix of demand to put in more housing, people wanting those sort of short-term economic benefits. They want to be near the coast. And then the long-term consequences of what happens when the sea level rises, when the beach erodes, when these floods happen, and all of that is put at risk. Mm-hmm. And it creates this huge problem, which from an academic standpoint is fascinating to study and try to dig into all of the complications.
Should we be really like living next to the coast and doing this? Are we just making mistake after mistake and building these houses?
Well, I think that's the real core of the question, right? Is what is the value? Why do some people feel the need to live there, whereas other people feel like they could live nearby and visit the coast? And I think different states and different communities have really different answers to that. Thinking about this, like people like living on the coast because they like being near the beach. It forms part of their identity. It, you know, has all these wonderful amenities. But yeah, there is this fundamental question of, is that a place where people should live? Like when you go back in history, you know, 100 years ago or 200 years ago, a lot of people didn't build next to the coast. That wasn't desirable housing because it was risk prone, because they knew that if a flood happened or a hurricane happened, their house would be damaged. And it's more recently, as we've built more levees and we've done more engineering, that people start thinking, oh, maybe that's okay. Maybe we can engineer our way out of this problem. And so we build more and more. And now I think we're swinging back on that pendulum to the point where maybe we actually can't engineer our way out of this entire problem, right? Maybe we can limit that problem, but in some places that doesn't work. And so we're trying to find other solutions. And I think that's where we're starting to talk about. One of the things I study is managed retreat, is people who actually relocate away from these risk-prone areas because they've started to realize that maybe living there isn't the safest idea or the best idea economically.
I saw some of that in your research. Okay, let's get into that a little bit, the managed retreat. I thought these were some great ideas, but share that a little bit with us.
So when we think about adaptation to risks in general, think about climate change adaptation, we talk about categories of options. So you can sort of resist. And when we talk about resist, usually we mean, say, building a flood wall. You prevent the water from reaching your house. You can accommodate the water. So maybe you elevate your home, the water comes and it goes, but you're high and dry, so there's less damage being done. You can retreat, which is move your house away from the floodwaters so that the water comes and goes and you're not there, so it doesn't matter. Or you can avoid, which is don't build there in the first place. And we're not doing a great job at avoid, but yeah. You know, now that we've had these buildings there, like once you've put a home in the floodplain, then you're kind of looking at it thinking, well, what do we do now? Right. And those are the big categories of options. There's tons of options within each of those categories, but those are the big options. And historically, the US, like in the last century, we've mostly been doing resistance and accommodation. So we've been elevating homes, building levees, building flood walls, trying to shore up the shore and keep people in their homes. And more recently, just in the last few decades, we've started to see more people, more communities thinking about maybe some of these homes need to move. Maybe some of these homeowners want to move, right? They're sick of living behind a flood wall, or they're sick of being flooded all the time. But it's a really challenging strategy, right? People live where they live for a lot of good reasons, and some of them are really loath to leave there.
What about like a hybrid solution where you've got multiple different ways of, or you're taking those various managed retreat solutions and putting them all together?
I think this is what we're going to have to see in the future, because we tend to talk about these as though they're alternatives. Like either we're going to build a flood wall, or we're going to do managed retreat, or we're going to elevate. And one of the reasons they can feel like alternatives is different federal agencies fund different strategies. So the U.S. Army Corps of Engineers mostly funds building seawalls, whereas FEMA mostly home elevation and property buyouts, and HUD helps with property buyouts. So you kind of have to do these different agencies, and it can feel like you have to do one or the other. But the best solutions are probably going to involve all of the above, right? When we think about Miami and how it's going to deal with sea level rise, it's probably going to have some seawalls, some home elevations, some neighborhoods relocating, and some other strategies, dune renourishment and wetland restoration, all types of things. You know, you can think about the categories like the ingredients in a recipe, and you can create different recipes depending on how you mix them and how much you have of each different option. So we don't want to have one thing that's all retreat or one place that's all resistance. You're probably going to have a mix of the above. And the tricky bit is figuring out how much of each one makes sense in a given place.
Well, I feel like that's kind of the happy medium in all of this, right? Like you're getting the best of both worlds. And, you know, because you're doing this, okay, well, you think about the seawalls. Like, and, you know, we have in the city I live in, we do have there's a small seawall that's protecting some of these houses that they built below flood level, which is why did they do that? I don't know, but they did. So they have the seawall, and you know, they've got like some areas where you can walk on the seawall and all of that, but really those houses, they have zero view of the water now because of the seawall. So it's like, okay, you're missing out on that. So perhaps if there was a hybrid solution, you can have the seawalls a little bit lower, the house is a little more elevated, and maybe it is making things a little bit better.
We are going to see a lot of hybrids. And, you know, you raise an interesting point, which is that all of these strategies have trade-offs. They all have pros and cons, right? You're behind a levee. Great. Your home is safer. The water can't get in, at least as long as the levee's maintained and it's, well, you know, it's a good levee. But yeah, you lose your view of the ocean. Right. And I think this is the point where we start having to have some really tough conversations as communities to think about what matters most to you. Do you care most about living here, you know, in this exact neighborhood, in this exact house? Do you care most about having a view of the ocean? Do you care most about having access to the beach? Because building that levee might destroy access to the beach if the water rises up to the point where it meets the levee and there's no sand on the beach side. So, you know, we have to start thinking about which of these things is our priority. And those are really hard conversations. And that's an answer where there isn't a right or wrong engineering answer, right? That's not something you can plug into a mathematical formula and say this is right or wrong. That's our values. That's our personal,
your emotional attachment to the area.
Your emotions about it.
Yeah.
And people have really strong emotions, really strong opinions about their communities. And so these conversations aren't going to be a scientific engineering, here's the right answer. They're going to have to be these harder, more emotional conversations about what we want the community to look like in the future.
Right.
And personally, that's really challenging because those emotions are hard. So it's really difficult conversations, you know, examples of communities that start fighting over this, and it can really, really cause a lot of heartache. At the same time, mostly because climate change can be so depressing to talk about, I try to find the optimism in it. I think this is an area where it can be optimistic. Like, while we're thinking about what really matters to us, let's talk about how we could do better at emphasizing whatever it is that we care about most.
Well, and that's going to be so different per person. Like in one community, you could have people wanting different things. In one city, you're definitely going to have that. How do we keep this equitable? How do we keep this fair when making these types of decisions?
One of the big questions that comes up with this sort of equity and fairness is whose homes are going to be protected behind a flood wall and whose homes are going to be relocated? And what you worry about, what you don't want to see, is you don't want to see all the rich homes, the wealthy homes, being protected and the low-income neighborhoods being relocated and forced out, right? You want to make sure that this is being done in a way that's fair to everyone and doesn't just give the amenities of being on the coast to wealthy homeowners. And that's a problem because that seems to be what we're seeing right now, is that more wealthy homeowners are getting protected by flood walls because they can pay for them on their own or because the local government wants to protect those property taxes. Right. And lower income neighborhoods maybe are getting relocated more often because it's not cost effective to build a flood wall in front of a lower income neighborhood.
Right. Now, So I didn't write this down, but you mentioned earlier some of the government organizations that are managing this. The retreat method is different per the organization. Is that just we're seeing certain communities move because that's the organization or the government organization that's going in? Is that why that change is happening?
Well, so that's actually a really interesting question, and it's one I want to learn more about. So that's actually one of the research questions I'm hoping to find out more. I wonder if that's happening, right? A disaster occurs, and if the U.S. Army Corps is the first person to show up and they say, hey, we have money for a flood wall,
so that's,
you build a flood wall.
Right.
And if FEMA shows up first and says, hey, we have money for for home elevations, you elevate homes, right? And I don't know how much the community is really sitting down and saying, is a flood wall best or is elevation best?
Yeah, and that's perhaps the only advice that they're getting. And, you know, when the only tool you have is a hammer, everything looks like a nail, right? That old saying.
Exactly.
You know?
Everything looks like, yeah. Well, and this is an area where I think it's one of the reasons that historically we've built so many levees and so many flood walls, right? It's like they worked for a while, they worked in certain circumstances. And so we started using that hammer. And so everything looks like a build a flood wall solution.
Right.
Right. And now we're starting to see that, hey, maybe putting levees all along the Mississippi actually has caused some real problems because of the way it's changed sediment and changed flooding. And we're not maintaining those levees, right? Those are expensive things to maintain. Mm-hmm. So when they're not maintained, people think they're safe, but they're actually not safe. And when those levees are overtopped or they break. Anyway, yeah, there's a problem with relying on just one strategy, is that you can tend to overuse it in scenarios where maybe it wasn't the right answer. Just because it worked somewhere else doesn't mean it's going to work in your community.
All right. So we got to get into some of the money spent by the government and some of the ways that the government is handling this. We'll get into that. We'll take a short break here. When we come back, we'll continue the conversation. If you enjoy history, maybe you're just feeling a little nostalgic, or you wonder who's having a birthday today, or maybe you need a reason to celebrate. Well, we've got the perfect podcast for you. It is called This Is Today. And each and every day, we talk about the historic events, celebrity birthdays. We also talk about whatever is going on today. There's always something to celebrate when you listen to This Is Today. And at just 10 minutes each day, you can make it a daily habit. You can even add it to your Alexa Flash briefing. click the link in the description or just search in your favorite podcast app for This Is Today. Thanks for listening and subscribing to Learning More. We're underwater in this episode. We're talking water. We're talking ways to adapt to our changing climate. It's a frustrating and interesting topic, and we're also trying to put a positive spin on it. I'm talking with A.R. Siders, an assistant professor. I want to talk a little about the money behind all of this, and specifically the government money that's spent on this. Billions of dollars spent on cleaning up after a disaster, but I don't really hear about the money going in to help us up front to prevent that disaster. It almost feels like the government is like, let's have the insurance companies pay for this, or let's have, you know, personal people pay for this instead of us. Is that like happening, or what's going on here?
All right. There's at least two pieces in that. So the first bit is like the mitigation. So reducing the risk, preventing the disaster from happening versus paying for it afterwards. And you're spot on that historically, the U.S. has done so much more on post-disaster recovery. We spend hundreds of billions of dollars post-disaster recovery, right? And we spend very little pre-disaster mitigation. There's an effort to change this. So FEMA now has a program called BRIC, Building Resilient Infrastructure and Communities, and it's supposed to be aimed explicitly at trying to reduce risk. It's had other programs in the past, FEMA has, but this is supposed to be a bigger program with more emphasis on how do we reduce risk. One of the real challenges is that federal government doesn't have authority to stop people from building in floodplains or fire-prone areas. That's local government. And local government doesn't have an incentive to do it.
Right.
So if local government gets more money, the more houses they build, because they get property tax revenue, they get the population boost, et cetera. So there's some great work by Linda Shai showing that local governments actually have a financial incentive to build more homes, even if they know that they're in a hazard-prone area. And the federal government, who doesn't have any authority to prevent that, is then left holding the bill when those homes are flooded or burnt down or destroyed in a disaster. And so there's this real mix between who's paying for it and who has the authority to reduce the risk in the first place. Mm. So FEMA's stuck in the middle, trying to use this money to try to incentivize local governments to take action. But that's hard because they're fighting against all of these incentives. And then the other thing you mentioned with the insurance companies is like, that's a whole can of worms on its own. So the real question with insurance is, what do you do when the insurance companies won't insure a property, when it's too risky? So with flood-prone properties back in the 60s, a bunch of flood insurance companies said, it is too risky. You are building homes in areas that are so risky that we will not insure them. So the federal government created the National Flood Insurance Program, and we're still running it today. And so the federal government actually provides flood insurance for homes that are located in the floodplain. And I love the quote one guy writes about this. He says, it's like a car insurance company that only provides policies to drunk 16-year-old boys. That's it. That's the only people, like the only people you give this to are people who you know will have accidents, right? Is we're only going to give flood insurance policies to people we know will be flooded.
Oh, man.
And so as a result, this program is bankrupt. Like, it, you know, it's overdrawn.
Yeah.
It doesn't get enough money. So there's all kinds of efforts trying to fix it. And it's a huge problem. And now we're seeing the problem happen with wildfire. Because now wildfire insurance companies are saying, hey, these wildfires are so big, we don't want to insure these homes anymore. And states like California are saying, whoa, if you don't insure these homes, what's going to happen to the homeowners when that home burns down? And so I think there is this idea of like, you want the insurance companies to do more, and they're trying to do more because they are out hundreds of billions of dollars. And look at reinsurance companies who insure the insurance companies who are paying all this. It's hugely expensive to them, and they want more action taken. But again, you have to create an incentive for the local government to actually step in and say, no, you shouldn't build there in the first place. And that's really hard to convince a local government to do, you know, to stand up to a developer, to stand up to a homeowner and say, no, you can't build or you can't rebuild.
Right.
That's hard.
Yeah, well, you know, you mentioned California. I mean, one of the issues that we have in California is the state is essentially forcing more houses to be built because they want lower income houses, which makes sense.
Yeah.
But there's also this factor where are those being built? Are they being built in areas that are disaster prone?
It's a huge problem. I mean, I work mostly in flood, but nationally, government-sponsored housing, so government-subsidized affordable housing, about some estimates are 10% of that is inside the floodplain.
Wow.
So we're building affordable housing for people who need government subsidized housing, and we're putting it in areas where these people are going to experience floods. Right. And it's a real challenge everywhere, right? The housing crisis. But it does suggest that we have to come up with some new strategies. And this is, you know, trying to be optimistic again. Like, this is where I try to see optimism, that I think there are a lot of creative strategies for how we can build affordable housing, how we can build more densely in the cities we have, if we choose to go that route, right? It's about, are we really ready to prioritize building safe, affordable housing?
Right.
And I'm not sure that that's really been a priority the way it should be. And if it were, we could find strategies to do that.
Okay, I said we try to take it on a bit of a positive note here, right? Yeah.
It's hard sometimes, I know.
Yeah. Let's talk about some of the spending on infrastructure bills. There's one that could happen right now. Let's talk about that. If you were in charge, what would you put inside of an infrastructure bill?
Well, I think one of the things is long-term maintenance for our flood management infrastructure. So the United States has hundreds of miles and more than that of levees and flood walls all across the United States. And the American Society of Civil Engineers, it goes in and it grades this infrastructure, right, A through F, and only 8% is considered acceptable condition.
Wow.
So that means 92% of the flood walls that people are living behind are not considered to be in acceptable condition. They need to be updated. And they estimate that it would cost $100 billion just to repair them. Not to put them up to climate change levels, not to increase them, not to do any future maintenance, just to get them all to an acceptable level. And then you're talking $15 billion a year after that, every year, just to maintain them. Hmm. So the infrastructure bills that come in and they give a short influx of money are great, but you have to wonder about where is that $15 billion every year going to come from, not from the next 5 years or next 10 years of the bill, but for the next 100 years.
Yeah.
Right. And that's a really big question. And when we're thinking about climate change adaptation, we're thinking about all this, we have to be thinking in the hundreds of billions of dollars. I mean, the price tag is going to be enormous. Whether we do retreat or we build flood walls or we elevate homes, it's going to be gigantic. And it doesn't feel like we've actually started planning for that in a realistic way.
When you say the price tag of $15 billion a year, I would think we probably spend more than that on fixing the issues after they've happened, right?
Well, this goes back to that push of where do you spend your money, right? Most of the calculations that come out estimate somewhere between, well, I've seen as much as for every dollar you spend on flood mitigation, so building flood walls, relocating homes, elevating them, you save $4 down the road. And some people will go as high as $8 saved. So if you think about that, that's a 400%, to 800% investment. That's a really solid investment. But convincing, especially local governments or especially, say, small towns who maybe are struggling with their budgets anyway, to try to come up with that cash up front is really hard.
Right.
They know they might save money down the line, but coming up with that tax, the upfront capital investment, I think is part of the trick. So how do we do that?
Well, it just feels like, I mean, every podcast I talk about either, about city planning or, future proofing or future planning, like we've always been very much about today and not about tomorrow. So it goes along with that theme, unfortunately. And there's very little that we can do aside from, vote, I guess, as far as the federal government level.
Voting is really important, though. And actually, I've become convinced that anyone listening to this podcast, like one of the real challenges is get involved in your local planning board, because your local planning board is the person who's deciding whether affordable housing is built, whether they invest in repairing flood infrastructure, mm-hmm. and whether or not they build new homes in the floodplain.
Right.
And so few people actually participate in local planning boards that you can have a real difference if you show up and make your voice.
Yeah. Well, that's what I was going to say. On the federal level, you can't do much, but on the local level, you can jump in and actually make a difference.
And local levels where we need action at the local level right now. That's where we need people to speak up.
Right. Yeah. So one of my first jobs, was a cameraman at a city council meetings. Wow.
Oh, that sounds like a tough.
There were nights that were felt like they would never end. But the thing was, you got the same few people going in there over and over and over again to try to make this point. And I just always thought as I was sitting there, aside from how do I stay awake tonight, but I always thought like, if more people came in here and actually made a point about something, more things would get done. Yeah. Okay. So outside of the government, let's talk about just us personally. What can we do to make a difference?
Well, okay. So usually my answer to that is go to the planning boards, mm-hmm. right? Is engage with the local government. Because I think the United States has had such a tradition of wanting local governments like towns and cities to have authority. But that really depends on the people who are in them participating. Right. But so really engaging, I think, is incredibly important. The other thing I'll note is to educate yourself. Because for example, when you purchase a new home, right, if you're buying or if you're renting, some states, the seller is required to tell you that your home is in the floodplain mm-hmm. and that you are at risk yeah. and that you'll have to buy flood insurance and so forth. But some states you're not. There's no requirement. Like Florida, Massachusetts, there is no requirement for the home seller to tell you that the home has a history of flooding, that it is in the floodplain, that you will be required to purchase flood insurance. So it really puts the onus on the buyer to educate yourself about flood risk. And I say this because I really worry about you're reading these news stories about people whose homes flood and they say, wow, I wish I'd known that it flooded before I bought it. You know, before I made this huge financial decision and put my family at risk, et cetera. And we need to fix the systems. We need to create systems that will give people that information. But in the meantime, you can really help by educating yourself about it and trying to take that step mm-hmm. Because that'll help push the system to fix itself.
Yeah. The other thing I would mention, if you're buying a home in a flood area or a wildfire area, look up the insurance before you actually make that offer because it can be expensive.
It can be very expensive. Yeah. Sometimes you're talking tens of thousands of dollars a year.
Yeah. Hey, thank you so much for joining me today and talking to us about this.
Yeah. Thank you for discussing this issue. It's always great to have more conversations about these things. They're hard to talk about, but they don't get easier for avoiding them. So.
Right. And you know what? There is another positive. We're not avoiding it. We're talking about it, right? Three episodes on climate change over the last 3 weeks. I thank you for listening to those. I thank you for subscribing. If you missed any of those episodes, hey, they're right there. Just subscribe to the podcast. Go back and listen to the last couple of episodes. And you know what? Next week, we're going to talk laugh therapy. Yeah, it's a thing. And you know who came up with that? Alan Funt from Candid Camera. Remember the show Candid Camera? I loved that show. And it's still around on YouTube, Candid Camera Classics. We are going to be talking with Peter Funt, Alan's son, who kind of took over the whole Candid Camera empire. He's might be coming back on TV soon. So we'll learn more about laugh therapy, Candid Camera, and we'll talk with Peter Funt next time on Learning More. Hey, also, check out our daily show, This Is Today. There's a link in the podcast description. Thanks for listening. I'm Russ, and I'll talk to you next time.